from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Israel steps up attacks on day three of its Gaza offensive. The U.S. Defense Secretary calls ISIL an imminent threat.
This is a force that is sophisticated, it's dynamic, it's strong, it's organized, it's well-financed, it's competent.
A human rights group blasts Fortress Europe, and great whales rebound as marine engineers. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Israel has escalated attacks on the Hamas-ruled Gaza Strip in the third day of a major offensive. Palestinians say at least 80 people have been killed, including many civilians. There have been no Israeli fatalities. Robert Berger reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli warplanes struck more than 320 targets in Gaza, linked to the ruling Islamic militant group Hamas. The military said the strikes destroyed tunnel networks, rocket launching sites, and the homes of Hamas commanders. Since the offensive began on Tuesday, Israel has attacked more than 750 targets in Gaza. Israeli Army spokesman Peter Lerner says the aim of the operation is to stop waves of Palestinian rocket attacks that are threatening civilians.
Primarily, we are out to strike at Hamas. We can't allow them to keep Israel, those 1 million Israelis, living as hostages to their rockets.
While Hamas is the target, Palestinian civilian casualties are mounting. In the deadliest attacks, a family of eight was killed when a bomb hit a house, and at least eight others died when an airstrike blasted a Gaza beach cafe where people were watching the World Cup. Hamas is hitting back. It continues to fire dozens of rockets at Israeli cities, including Tel Aviv, but many have been shot down by Israel's Iron Dome anti-missile system. Hamas spokesman Mushir al-Masri vowed the group would keep on fighting and strike at Israel from the land, sea, and air. Speaking in China, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry backed Israel.
No country can accept rocket fire aimed at civilians, and we support completely Israel's right to defend itself against these vicious attacks.
Kerry said the United States will do everything possible to try to bring an end to the violence. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has urged both Israel and the Palestinians to exercise maximum restraint and return to meaningful peace talks. Mr. Ban said he spent much of the day Wednesday telephoning world and regional leaders trying to contain the spiraling crisis. He said the new wave of violence is one of the most critical tests the region has faced in recent years.
The risk of violence expanding further still is real. Gaza and the region as a whole cannot afford any other full-blown war.
The UN chief condemned the rockets launched by the Islamic militant group Hamas into Israel and said he urged Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to respect international obligations to protect civilians. Mr. Bond said he knows emotions are running very high, but he said calm must quickly be restored.
The lives of countless innocent civilians and the peace process itself are in the balance.
Yossi Meckelberg, professor of international relations at Regent's University London, says the escalating violence is a sign of political weakness on both sides.
Netanyahu is under pressure from the more right wing in his government, the Bennett's and Liebermans of his coalition. The Hamas is weak because they had to leave Damascus before, because the fall of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt.
The Muslim Brotherhood government in Cairo was forced from power last year by the military. Its replacement under Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has attempted to mediate between Israel and the Palestinians and could yet play a key role, says Middle East analyst Sharif Nashahibi.
This particularly now would suit Sisi as a new president. You know, his credentials are rather shaky with Western leaders. So I think this would be an opportunity for him to come out, firstly looking strong and you know, with authority to his own people, but showing the West that he is a pivotal player in the region.
Hamas will be looking for regional support, but in neighboring Syria, the balance of power has swung against the Palestinian faction, says Nashahibi.
Hamas came out in support of the revolution against Bashar Assad in Syria, so they had to leave Syria. That cost them Iranian support, which was substantial at the time. And the recent deal within the Gulf Cooperation Council members regarding the dispute with Qatar has been sorted out, and there is, you know, speculation that that may mean a kind of softening of support of Qatari support for Hamas, although that hasn't been stated.
The West is reluctant to get deeply involved, says Yossi Meckelberg.
As long as the level of casualties remains low, I think both the Europeans and the Americans will let the Israelis to keep the military campaign to weaken the Hamas, especially the military wing, but then they might want something in return politically, diplomatically.
Yossi Meckelberg with Regent's University, London. The top U.S. defense official says the world should not underestimate the threat posed by the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. BYU's Jeff Selden reports from the Pentagon.
Speaking with sailors during a visit to a naval submarine base in the southern U.S. state of Georgia, U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel didn't hold back when asked about renewed American involvement in Iraq.
ISIL may not appear to be an imminent threat to the United States. It is a threat to the United States. It is a threat, clear threat, to our partners in that area, and it is imminent.
Hagel said Washington's doing everything it can to help the Iraqi security forces fight back against ISIL's brutality, but he warned defeating the group will not be easy.
This is a force that is sophisticated, it's dynamic, it's strong, it's organized, it's well-financed, it's competent.
The U.S. has intensified surveillance flights over Iraq, now flying about 50 a day, and has opened joint operation centers in Baghdad and to the north in Erbil, while 9 ships, including an aircraft carrier, are positioned in the Persian Gulf. But just how much farther ISIL can push remains a question. Tony Bedran at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies spoke to VOA via Skype.
Its successes mainly have been now against weak, disorganized, demoralized, or even subverted in certain cases, like penetrated groups, let's say, where you have a Sunni contingent deployed in a Sunni province.
And while ISIL poses an imminent threat to the region, Bedran says much of the group's talk may be nothing more than posturing.
Understand ISIS as part of a local phenomenon. They may talk global, but their objectives, as we see them now, at least in the short to medium term, are very much local.
The U.S. has 6 teams of commandos on the ground in and around Baghdad, charged with assessing the state of Iraqi forces and the overall security situation. Pentagon officials say those assessments could be submitted any day now. Jeff Selden, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Rights group Amnesty International claims Europe is cracking down on illegal immigration, which is costly, and closing the doors to refugees fleeing conflict. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
Issued Wednesday, a new report by Amnesty International claims measures adopted by European governments to staunch illegal immigration are not only costing taxpayers billions of dollars, but are creating new dangers for Syrians and others seeking refuge from conflict. Yasser Kadtigani is deputy director of Amnesty's Europe and Central Asia program.
The European Union is making its utmost to protect its borders and has built a fortress Europe. But the cost of all of this is actually the human rights violations of migrants and refugees trying to reach Europe and taking very dangerous journeys to reach the continent.
According to Amnesty, the European Union spent about $2.8 billion protecting its external borders between 2007 and 2013. Amnesty says the 28-member bloc spent less than a third of that amount to improve conditions for refugees and asylum seekers within its borders. The report, Tigani says, aims to raise public awareness.
Trying as well to make Europeans to think about, you know, what is happening at their doorstep, you know, what is happening at their borders, and what are their governments doing not to allow people who are in need of international protection.
New statistics show nearly 500,000 people applied for asylum in the European Union last year, the highest number recorded since the bloc began collecting data 6 years ago. Many refugees from the Middle East and North Africa make a perilous journey across the Mediterranean to reach Europe's doors. Earlier this week, EU Home Affairs Commissioner Cecilia Malmström urged member nations to take in more Syrians and other asylum seekers.
There is a strong emphasis on assisting Syrians at the moment, but there are also other countries that would need support. And people do embark on rickety vessels, on very dangerous travels, because there are very few, if any, legal ways to get to Europe. And one way to come to Europe in a safe way would be through increased resettlement.
At the same time, Commissioner Malmström says new European laws will lead to fairer and better asylum decisions in Europe and better protection and reception for asylum seekers. But Amnesty says more needs to be done to turn legislation into action. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. VOANews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. VOANews.com. Online news for a changing world.
The United States military is scaling back its counterterrorism assistance program in the southern Philippines after more than a decade of regular rotations. From Manila, Simon Orendain reports on what the move will mean for a region that is still facing security threats.
U.S. government officials say their work with the armed forces of the Philippines has been successful at drastically reducing the capabilities of domestic and transnational terrorist groups. Casey Staley, the U.S. spokesman for the Joint Special Operations Task Force Philippines, says the groups have devolved into criminal elements.
The time has come to reevaluate our position here and how best we can continue to support the Philippine security forces. And so with that in mind, military planners from both the United States and the Philippines are looking at ways to adjust our presence as far as JSOTFP goes.
Staley says the focus is shifting from helping with on-the-ground tactical efforts to strategy and planning. He says there are 320 U.S. troops in the task force. A smaller contingent of high-ranking officials will be involved in the strategic work. A year after the September 11th terrorist attacks in the United States, the U.S. started rotating troops to the southern island Mindanao, whose smaller island provinces are home to a terrorism group with links to al-Qaeda. The Abu Sayyaf group was once notorious for large-scale bombings, but in the past 12 years, its ranks dwindled to a few hundred as military operations intensified with U.S. troop support. Also, its funding source dried up when terror financing was blocked worldwide. The ASG dropped its ideological motives and became known for kidnappings for ransom, beheadings, and bombings. Matt Williams, the Philippine country director for the business risk consultant group Pacific Strategies and Assessments, says as the United States scales back its counterterrorism program here, there is still a terror threat in neighboring Malaysia and Indonesia.
Does the Philippine military and intelligence services have the capacity right now to continue to contain these groups from spreading into the Philippines, or will a lot of the successes over the last 10 years be lost?
Carl Baker with the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies says the government and the country's largest Muslim rebel group have made important progress in working on a newly signed peace pact to form an autonomous area in the south. But he says domestic threats still remain.
There's still a lot of loose ends that need to be tied up. And in any situation like the longstanding conflict that's been going on in the southern Philippines, is you have these splinter groups, these spoiler groups who can still cause disruption.
For nearly 40 years, Muslims in Mindanao fought government forces in an insurgency that left more than 120,000 people dead. After 16 years of off-and-on negotiations, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front forged a peace deal with the government. But several other Muslim factions opposed the agreement. Last September, Philippines forces fought a faction of the Moro National Liberation Front for weeks after it held 200 people hostage in the city of Sambanga. The Bangsamoro Islamic Freedom Fighters continue bombing operations against the military, and a tiny group calling for an Islamic caliphate is believed to have forged an alliance among the Indonesia-based Jamaah Islamiyah and other Philippine militant groups. Rodolfo Mendoza, a terrorism expert at the Philippine Institute for Peace, Violence and Terrorism Research, says these smaller groups are banding together.
The peace process is still closed door to them. They are considered terrorists. And so they have to maximize their plan of terrorist operations. And they are doing that.
Mendoza says bomb-making and other militia training continues among those groups. But with the success in Sambanga behind it, the Philippine Armed Forces, which has one of the smallest military budgets in Asia, says it has the experience to handle such threats. Armed Forces spokesman General Domingo Totaan says the change in the U.S. counterterrorism program will not affect Philippine military operations in the South.
They have been undertaking also training of trainers, so the transfer of knowledge and expertise is still going to be ongoing.
Baker says the transition also follows the Philippines' own shift to focus more on protecting its territory and dealing with outside threats. Its military modernization program is heavily geared toward bolstering external defense. U.S. military spokesman Casey Staley says the Joint Special Operations Task Force in the Philippines will cease to exist in the first half of 2015. Simone Orendain for VOA News, Manila.
The Obama administration says African leaders should honor constitutional term limits. VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns has that story.
The U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, says President Barack Obama's call for strong institutions in Africa includes respecting limits on power.
If constitutions call for term limits, then those term limits need to be honored. And we have been very clear in discouraging African leaders from making changes in their constitution that will benefit one person or one party to allow that person to stay in power longer than the constitution intended for them to stay in power.
Taking questions from reporters Wednesday before next month's African Leaders Summit in Washington, Thomas-Greenfield was asked about prospects that Burkina Faso President Blaise Compaoré and Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila might change their constitutions to run again. The diplomat said there is absolutely no confusion about Washington's position on rolling back term limits. She said the administration has made its views on the subject known to all of the leaders where there are attempts to make changes in the constitution. 51 African leaders have been invited to next month's summit. Every leader on the continent, except Sudan's Omar al-Bashir, Eritrea's Isaias Afwerki, and Zimbabwe's Robert Mugabe. Thomas-Greenfield says the summit will include talks on combating threats from the al-Qaeda-linked groups al-Shabaab and al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, as well as the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram. U.S. officials are in Nigeria to help in the hunt for young women kidnapped by the group, which is blamed for thousands of deaths in recent years.
It is still an ongoing battle. Our ultimate goal is to stop Boko Haram, to stop the kidnappings, and to bring the girls home, as well as others who have been kidnapped by Boko Haram.
Thomas-Greenfield also called for rival factions in South Sudan to honor the terms of a ceasefire and prevent what she calls a man-made famine because farmers cannot get to their fields. Scott Stearns, VOA News at the State Department.
The World Health Organization says there have been at least 50 new cases of Ebola in Liberia and Sierra Leone since July 3rd, in what is already the worst outbreak in history. The aid group Plan International says the outbreak could become a global health crisis if there isn't a better coordinated regional response and more support from the international community. Jennifer Lazuta reports from VOA's West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
West Africa's Ebola outbreak shows little sign of slowing down. The World Health Organization says there have now been 844 cases and 518 deaths in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone since the outbreak began in February. While no new cases have been reported in Guinea in the past week, the number of suspected cases and the death toll continues to rise on an almost daily basis in Liberia and Sierra Leone. Dr. Unnikrishnan, the head of disaster preparedness and response for Plan International, said the situation is extremely worrying.
We are talking about countries with some of the weakest health systems and health infrastructure, and with each passing day, the demand on agencies who are active on the ground has been increasing. So we are stretched to our limits now.
He says health officials need to improve monitoring mechanisms within affected communities, as well as at border controls and airports. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
In the heyday of commercial whaling in the 19th and 20th centuries, the giant marine mammals were killed by the tens of thousands. By the time an international moratorium was put in place in 1986, some populations had declined by an estimated 66 to 90%. Since then, whale populations have rebounded, and VOA's Roseanne Scribble reports they are improving the ocean environment.
Great whales are the largest animals in the history of life on Earth. You might know them by their names, baleen, sperm, humpback, blue, and gray. Valued for their meat and oil, they were once considered of little consequence to the ocean. But we know better now, says University of Vermont conservation biologist Joe Roman, lead author of a new study in the journal Frontiers in Ecology and the Environment. It finds that great whales have a powerful and positive impact on how the ocean works. He spoke via Skype.
They can increase nutrients in areas where they're feeding. So whales dive deep to feed. They come to the surface, and as it turns out, they defecate or they release whale poop at the surface. That has lots of nitrogen and other nutrients, so it can increase productivity in the areas where whales are feeding.
Whales continue to service the ocean even when they die and sink to the deep sea, Roman says.
That also brings nutrients down there and lots of habitats for species that depend entirely on those whale falls.
After centuries of decline, great whales are steadily repopulating their historic breeding and feeding grounds, and they have a healthy appetite. Some commercial fisheries argue the whales are eating too many other fish and taking a big bite from their profits. Roman says the opposite is true.
I think that the classic view was too many whales, not enough fish. But our study and several others are starting to show that it's far more complicated, more interesting than that. That is, when whales are in a healthy ecosystem, we can have more fish and more whales at the same time.
Roman argues whales are being blamed for poor fishery management.
If we can restore our waterways, if we can better manage our fisheries, we're going to find that we'll have more whales for us to enjoy, as well as more fish for commercial fisheries, for recreational fisheries.
But even as whales rebound, they are not immune to human threats in the ocean. They are run over by container ships, caught in fishing nets, and disturbed by noise from ocean traffic and sonar signals. Margaret Williams, who directs the World Wildlife Fund's Arctic program, spoke via Skype.
So shipping is increasing in the Arctic. Plans for offshore oil and gas development are increasing. And so World Wildlife Fund is working with government and communities and industry and other conservation groups to identify those areas that are very, very important for whale species, for migration areas, for feeding areas, and we're recommending that those areas receive special management attention.
William says whales deserve this protection. They are, as the study underscores, more valuable than whalers ever imagined to us, to fisheries, and to the ocean itself. Roseanne Scribble, VOA News, Washington.
Argentina has positioned itself to win its first World Cup in nearly 30 years, beating the Netherlands in a penalty shootout 4-2 after a scoreless draw. The Argentines converted all four of their penalty shots against Dutch goalie Jesper Sillissen. Maxi Rodriguez put away the winning spot kick. Argentine goalie Sergio Romero saved penalty shots by Ron Ballar and Wesley Snyder. The result Wednesday at rainy Intercaro Stadium in Sao Paulo means Argentina plays Germany in Sunday's championship game at Maracana Stadium in Rio de Janeiro. Argentina is seeking its third World Cup title, having won in 1978 and in 1986. Argentina and Germany have met twice before in the World Cup championship game. Argentina won in 1986, and the Germans won in 1990. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.